Go ahead. Okay, well, thank you for coming by this morning. I'll try not to take a full hour of your time. I'm going to talk about two effects in spin transport. The first will be an effect that only exists in the presence of Coulomb interactions, which we call spin drag. And the second will be the one particular variant of the spin Hall effect. There have been a lot of different talks on the spin Hall effect and a lot of different variants. I'm going to talk about the quantized spin Hall effect in graphene. When is that stable to interactions? So a brief outline of the talk. Most of it will be about spin transport. I wanted to sneak in a tiny bit at the end where I'll actually be talking about quantum mechanics of many spin systems. I think that we're learning a little bit as far as how to understand collective physics of spin with quantum information. So that's about a 5-minute advertisement at the very end of the talk. And all of this work was done with my excellent graduate student, Senka Xu, who's here this semester, and Gil Raphael at Caltech, and then various experimentalists at Berkeley and UCSB. All right, so I think I'll skip over the motivational part very quickly. Obviously, what we're all interested in here is cases where, first of all, we'd be interested in more single spin physics, or at least the quantum nature of spin, rather than just magnetic domains of many spins that effectively behave classically. The sort of medium-term goal of spintronics, I'd say, would be to replace charge with spin as a carrier of information, as something that can be manipulated. So that is, I think of spintronics as more or less using spin as a classical degree of freedom, a classical bit rather than a quantum bit. And one reason why, for example, Intel has recently started putting a lot of money into this is that there's a belief that charge transport, the inefficiencies associated with charge-based electronics are going to stop the development of computer chips probably around 2020 or 2025. Maybe spin offers some hope for lower power consumption. Whether that's actually true maybe remains to be seen, but at least it's a hope. So almost all of what I talk about will be about this sort of medium-term goal, using spin currents, but not really using any sort of many-particle quantum coherence of the spins. Then the second part will be very briefly on coherent spin measurements. Obviously, that's a lot more difficult, and you all know this. Classical computing with spin really just requires being able to use spin as a bit rather than as a qubit. Okay, so quick reminder of what is a spin current. Well, when I say spin current, I'm always going to mean pure spin current, where I've got, say, n spin up electrons moving right, n spin down electrons moving left, so the net charge current is zero. And one obvious fact about spin currents from this picture is that unlike a charge current, a spin current carries two indices. This somewhat trivial fact will be a little bit important later on. One index is a spatial index, just like an ordinary charge current, and the other index tells me what direction of spin is being transported by the spin current. So even just in the number of indices, there's already a symmetry difference between spin and charge. So a difference that's important for experiment, one way to motivate the first part of the talk is just trying to understand and measure the basic differences between spin currents and charge currents. Well, one really basic difference is that spin is not really conserved. Angular momentum is conserved, but spin is only one kind of angular momentum. So we all know that in solids, an important process is that spin can convert to orbital angular momentum and vice versa. The simplest way to put this is there's some sort of L dot S coupling in an atom or in a solid, and therefore spin angular momentum can easily be converted to L. So that sounds at first glance like a negative, but there is one very positive aspect of spin orbit coupling, which is that experimentally there are a lot of probes that will couple to L but not to S. For example, electric dipole transitions driven by light or something like that. So that means because of L dot S coupling, we can pump spin by pumping L and then counting on spin orbit coupling to convert that to S. So the disadvantage is that, and this is very sensitive to what sort of material one is talking about, spin only has a finite lifetime. So if you want to do a conventional transport theory for spin, you either have to put in some relaxation process or else work on a short enough time scale that spin is effectively conserved. So I'm going to talk at first about optics experiments. And in these will be on time scales less than about 100 picoseconds, which for this material, gallium arsenide quantum wells, for the electrons in gallium arsenide quantum wells, 100 picoseconds is about the relaxation time of spin. So this is one sort of trivial difference between spin currents and charge currents. It's that charge currents, or at least charge buildup, is going to live forever because it's a conserved quantity. Spin buildup doesn't behave in the same way. Two slightly less trivial differences that I want to talk about now are, first of all, how sensitive are spin currents and charge currents to the Coulomb interaction? There's a pretty fundamental difference, it turns out. And second, what are the consequences of the symmetry differences between spin currents and charge currents? Okay, so to put in a little advertisement for an experimental done in Berkeley, if you actually want to measure spin dynamics in solids, well, there are a couple of old-fashioned ways to do that, say neutron scattering and NMR. Neutrons in particular, if you have a large 3D bulk crystal of good quality and you have enough time on a neutron machine, you can map out the spin response functions pretty well. But what I'll talk about is effectively a way to measure the same quantities that are measured in neutron scattering, but different materials, different time scales, different spatial scales, and in a tabletop experiment, and with more spatial resolution than with conventional NMR. And this is not to rule out various future developments of NMR or spin-resolved ARPES or something like that. Okay, so what I want to talk about are what are called transient grading measurements of spin Coulomb drag. So let me explain what a transient grading measurement is and then explain the phenomenon that was observed in this experiment and a little bit about the theory of this phenomenon. So first of all, if you either don't have access to a neutron facility or if you'd like to work in something like a two-dimensional system where neutrons are not really feasible, then suppose you do the following. I'm going to interfere at the surface of my sample two cross-polarized, that is, two linearly polarized beams, but with orthogonal polarizations. So the effect of this, as I move along the surface, if I ask about the polarization of the wave coming in, is that because of the optical path length difference between the two beams, it'll look like, say, right circular, left circular, right circular, left circular, etc. Now we know that in various semiconductors, a useful way to create a spin density is to put in circularly polarized light, because that will preferentially create electron hole pairs of a certain spin, depending on which circular polarization the incident beam has. So for the experiments I'm talking about, these are electron-doped gallium arsenide quantum wells. There are about 10 wells in each sample. Electron hole pairs are created, but the hole spin relaxation time is very fast, and the holes essentially just sit there on the time scale of the experiment. So even though optics always creates electron hole pairs, I'm going to forget about the holes and just talk about what the electrons do. So on the time scales that can be resolved, this is the pump part of the experiment. The probe part of the experiment is to just do the inverse process of scattering waves off the spin density grading that's been created. So what this allows you to measure is, given an initial oscillation of spin density at time zero, how does that oscillation decay in time? And I'll explain why that lets you measure spin diffusion in a second.
Sorry, Bill, these are doped samples, so
this
is the kind of experiment where you excite and the excess electrons recombine before this time happens, or you said that the holes just sit there, or are they just gone, actually? Often they do these experiments where they excite, the electrons recombine, and what's left with some polarization in the doped electrons.
I don't think that all the electrons have recombined. I don't think that the electron hole recombination time in these samples is so much shorter than a few picoseconds, but you can assume that, but I'm not absolutely sure. The holes lose their spin, but I don't think they recombine with the electrons. I think the holes lose their spin to the lattice rather than by recombination. It turns out that gallium arsenide, so you should probably ask an experimentalist this, but my belief is that it's much easier to do this coupling to create spin in gallium arsenide. That has to do with special features of the gallium arsenide crystal structure, effectively. So that's the reason why almost all of these optical spin experiments in semiconductors are done in gallium arsenide. So the short answer is it's not. What was that? The period of the grading is going to be a few microns, and temporal resolution, I'll show pictures in a second, will be picoseconds. To get micron resolutions in neutron scattering wouldn't actually be that hard, but to get this sort of time resolution would require doing inelastic neutron scattering with an extremely good energy resolution. So it's more the time than the space that is the new feature of this.
So here the electron hole recombinating can multiply picoseconds and the decoherence of the spin of the hole.
Exactly. So that's right. The time scales are hole spin relaxation time is something like shorter than 1 picosecond. Electron spin relaxation time is about 100 picoseconds. And electron hole recombination time, I don't have a number, but it's longer than... Yeah, it's longer than 100 picoseconds, that much.
So the subscale one, so is this of resonance, or is that...
off, I don't think it's on any particular resonance. I don't know what the efficiency is of how much incident power goes into creating spin density versus how much goes into heating and other things.
As you said, it's the hearing is something like microns, so that's pretty long wavelength. So it's inside the gap, actually, or you know, the frequency of light is less than the gap?
No, the frequency of the light is larger than the gap. I mean, it's slightly, it's comparable too, so you get some reasonable cross-section for absorption.
Sorry, I think the confusion is the period of grading and the period of light.
Oh, yeah.
No, is that coming in?
Sorry, that's right. The period of the grading is determined by the angle between these. I mean, the light wavelength here is much shorter than microns, definitely. I mean, this is, I think, 1.5 EV laser. Okay, so this is what you get in time for the relaxation. So the vertical units are sort of arbitrary. It's tough to measure the absolute magnitude of the spin density, but you can measure how it evolves in time. These are different temperatures, and this is the time running from 0 to about 12 picoseconds. So at high temperature, let me focus on what happens at high temperature because it's a little bit simpler. The relaxation is basically exponential, and if you look at different q vectors of the grading, it's something like e to the minus d q squared t, which is exactly what you'd expect for diffusion. So the important thing about what's causing that diffusion, again, spin itself is not relaxing. That is, spin is a conserved quantity. But what's happening on the time scale of the experiment is that the spins that make up the grating are just moving around because this is a heavily doped metallic two-dimensional electron gas. Fermi temperature is about 300 Kelvin. So the electrons are moving around and just smearing out the grating by their motion, even though spin is not relaxing. In fact, as you go down to lower temperature, you can see that the curves no longer look simply exponential. The basic picture for why these wiggles exist, and the red curve is what I actually worked on. It's the sort of kinetic theory to understand how the electrons are moving around and relaxing. What's happening, the reason why there's a ripple here, is that if I start off with a wave, and then I have electrons move nearly ballistically over the length scale of that spin wave, then I'll see oscillations when, say, well, I'll see a dip when the original peaks have moved to the valleys, and then I'll see a peak again when the original peaks have gone far enough that many of them are at the same, many of them have moved a period of the grating. So if you think about it for a while, you'll convince yourself that there should be some kind of oscillation here. So the argument for what's going on is going to be that even if spin is conserved, there's a Coulomb effect, which means that the diffusion constant that you measure in this way, even though spin is only moving because spin is attached to electrons and electrons are moving, the spin diffusion constant is much shorter, especially at high temperature, than the charge diffusion constant. Sorry, the spin diffusion constant is much smaller than the charge diffusion constant. And this is because of something called spin Coulomb drag that I think...
Can you say the word how the measurement of the
It's optical pump probe. So you probe with very nearly the same thing that you pump with. You put in two beams and you measure how much scattering is there at wave vector Q. So for example, if the wave had disappeared completely and it had become uniform, there would be no significant scattering at that Q.
Is not scattering done simultaneously with pump?
It's done some few picoseconds later, but it's... So if you like, the typical way this kind of experiment is done would be ordinary intensity pump probe. So rather than creating a grating of polarization, you would create a grating of intensity. This is how you can measure diffusion constant in various materials. So here, the only difference is that instead of an oscillation in intensity, you have an oscillation in polarization, which gives you this spin density.
But it's not wrong, right?
No, it's not wrong.
It's rated, essentially.
Yeah. So, let me give a quick pick. In these experiments, you can actually measure both phase and intensity. It's kind of subtle. It is possible to do a heterodyne trick to measure both the phase and the intensity, but all the data that I've shown is intensity phase at this point. I don't think it made an appearance in the published paper because the signal to noise is not as good as for the intensity. All right, so let me try and give a quick picture for why spin diffusion should be different from charge diffusion, even when spin is a conserved quantity. The picture is going to be the following. Suppose that I can effectively take the continuum limit and not worry about umklapp processes, which is appropriate for these quantum wells because the density Kf, if you like, is much very far away from the reciprocal lattice vector. So if I have two electrons bounce off each other, even if those electrons transfer momentum from one to the other, the total electron momentum is conserved, which means that the total charge current is conserved. If the total charge current is conserved, then that means that electron-electron collisions really have nothing to do with relaxation of charge currents. And this is why, if you remember when you took solids, the tau that appears as the ordinary charge current relaxation time is typically not tau electron-electron, it's tau electron impurity or electron phonon or something like that, at least if you don't worry about umklapp. So the reason why spin currents are different is really very classical. It's just that spins come in two flavors, which means if I imagine having, say, an electron come in with spin up, bounce off an electron with spin down, well, even if spin is conserved, and even if momentum is conserved, the spin current is not conserved. So in this simple example, a Coulomb collision has reversed the direction of the spin current even though the charge current isn't modified. So this is the intuitive explanation for why there is a spin drag effect. Now, if this seems a little strange, just remember that there's a famous Coulomb drag effect in bilayer systems or in pairs of quantum wires or something like that. The only important feature of spin for this argument is that it comes in two flavors. So I could just as easily have said, instead of there's a transfer of momentum from up to down, there's a transfer of momentum from electrons of type 1 to electrons of type 2, say, where type 1 could be electrons in layer 1 and type 2 could be electrons in layer 2 or whatever. So now, to make this quantitative,
can I ask a philosophical question?
Yes.
I could equally well think of it as the electron not exchanging momentum when it's exchanging their spin.
Both momentum and spin are conserved. I don't think that there's a an empirical difference between the two pictures. So I don't know that one is better. You can choose whichever you prefer.
Probably I'm aware of recent work about 2-3 years ago by Yushchenko, where kind of a theory of exactly what you're talking about has been
I know
there has been more theoretical work also by Irina D'Amico.
Yeah, the D'Amico and Vignali is going to come up in just a second. Just be patient. This other work, I'm not.
Experiment from the Harchenes group a couple of years ago, teaching to explain exactly in these terms and develop just kinetic equation description of what's happening.
Yeah, in that case, I should talk with you a little bit afterward because I don't think it's quite the same experiment, but I would be happy to chat.
The number of parameter actors should be F1HN, spin and current.
What was that?
If we want to describe the interaction in terms of number of parameters, should be F1 current and spin.
The Landau parameters typically are not going to, I mean, I think of the Landau parameters in Fermi liquid theory as not necessarily involving scattering. They're more the energy of non-number changing processes. I mean, there's a relation between those and scattering processes, but I don't think that. Okay, let me go ahead and say what I think the connection is to Fermi liquid theory in a second, but I don't think that this quantity is exactly the same as any of the Fermi liquid parameters. Okay, so one does a sort of simple extraction of the relaxation time, and then the good news is that there's an existing body of theoretical work on how to compare what you pull out, which is the spin current relaxation time, and this is just solution of a Boltzmann equation, it's nothing very fancy, to pull out an experimental number for the ratio of spin diffusion to charge diffusion. So the point of where I got involved in this particular experiment is just how can you look at the experimental data and pull out the spin current relaxation time. It turns out that the theory for the spin current relaxation time had been done before. It had been done before, I think, mostly by D'Amico and Vignali. I think the idea that there should be such a spin drag effect is actually quite old, but the really detailed calculation, as far as I know, was first done by these people. So let me explain the results, first of all. So if you look at a typical highly doped quantum well at around 300 Kelvin, the first fact is tau for electron-electron collisions is quite a bit shorter than tau for electron impurity collisions. So as a result, spin diffusion for the parameters in these experiments is maybe 5 or 10 times slower near room temperature than charge diffusion. Even though this is, you know, the simplest possible system, this is a metal, this is effectively just an RPA calculation, so there's nothing too dramatically complicated, but it's still a pretty strong effect. And then I think the real confirmation that this is the right picture is the following, and this is where I want to make the connection to Fermi liquid theory. If you remember why metals are stable to interaction, It's not that the Coulomb interaction is weak, it's that at low enough temperature, there's very little phase space for Coulomb collisions to be effective. That is, as you go down in temperature, the amount of phase space available for the Coulomb interaction vanishes as T squared, well, this depends on the dimensionality, but it vanishes as some power of T because there's very little phase space available for scattering. And a prediction of that is that tau electron-electron should become quite long at low temperatures. So in fact, these two should approach each other as temperature gets lower. Experimentally, it's hard to go below about 30 Kelvin because of heating effects. They are setting up to try and do a better job, but certainly these two do approach each other and become within 30 or 40% of each other. So the experimental change as a function of temperature is between at least a factor of 5 to a factor of 30 or 40%. So the moral of the story is that even when spin is conserved, even when momentum is conserved, spin currents need not be conserved, and that's a very elegant difference between spin current and charge current. Not very. So the typical way to phrase this, if you go back to the drag literature, this is sometimes called a drag transresistivity. A way to picture it is if I tried to, say, apply a current of spin up or spin in one wire, I can ask what is the effective drag voltage that builds up in the other wire with closed boundary conditions. So that ratio gives you, it's the only reason I write it this way, it's customary to put drag measurements in terms of some kind of transresistivity. This is the relation between diffusion constant ratio and transresistivity. Yeah, that's right. If you are in the diffusion regime, it's something like tau electron electron over tau electron impurity. I mean, if you don't worry about phonon scattering, which is important too. That's right. No, I think it's very significant in 3D. I think all it depends on is, as Professor Falco was saying, the ratio of scattering processes. There's nothing really specifically 2D about this.
Well, actually, the word Bayesian theorem
So here, T Fermi is about 300 Kelvin. The experiment can be done, the electron temperature is probably going down to about 30 Kelvin or a little bit lower and then sticking. So maybe up to 100 Kelvin, there's a clear approach of DS to DC, but it never completely gets there. And all of this, I should say, I'll flash up on the next slide, where kind of the places where this description needs to be improved. This seems to be the right description at high enough density. At low density, all kinds of other things happen that are not really well understood. So the next slide is kind of explaining why it's harder at low density.
Yeah, just ask because of, you know, in the original drag experiments, phonon drag was pretty cool.
Let's see. I don't think I did try and plug in the numbers at some point. I don't think that phonon drag is especially important for the parameters in this experiment, but I'm not sure.
Are they pumping above or below the phonon energy? They're below the actual phonon.
They're pumping at more than one EV. I'm not. You're worried about, but that's just a question about how much pump energy is going into phonons versus how much is going into the.
No, I mean, if you pump above the gap, but an energy above the bottom of the conduction band is lower than the output phonon,
you get
food
without
the
main. Oh, I see. No, I don't think it's that fine-tuned. I think they're well above.
These are both.
Yeah. So I don't think it's that fine-tuned that they can effectively tune phonon to zero.
There are a lot of experiments on sort of the diffusion rates in normal matters, and they are usually interpreted in terms of a normal diffusion constant without any interaction and a spin flip time. So if you interpret that, you would say, okay, you should not really take the normal interaction diffusion constant, but a smaller number.
Well, you should at least.
Given spin flip,
okay.
Spin flip time should be much longer than people.
It depends on the electron electrode. So remember, when you're talking about metals, you're talking about very high Fermi energy. So depending on the specific metal, you can be in the regime where this T squared is kicking in because you're so far below the Fermi energy. But unless you're in a situation where the electron-electron time is very long, then yes, then I think one result of this experiment is that people have been overestimating the spin diffusion constant in a variety of systems because they've been using the charge diffusion constant, which isn't right.
Isn't there a difference in the classes?
Oh yeah, there would be if you broke. You mean if you put in a magnetic field or if you broke SE2 or something?
Okay.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
You need to break it over to zero.
No. If you have no, the transresistivity is non-zero even if there's no broken symmetry between up and down. Like in the Coulomb argument, it doesn't. Yeah, in the Coulomb argument, it doesn't depend on.
Last question.
The assumption is that there's a very rapid process of equilibration. I mean, if you took a temperature between the excitation energy and the Fermi energy, and the bottom of the band, that would be a very high temperature. I think that typically in these.
You're using your own argument, spin is attached to the electron, which has been excited.
But I think the electron energy relaxation time with the lattice is much more rapid than the electron spin relaxation time with the lattice. So I think the energy relaxes quickly to something like a thermal distribution, maybe not quite the lattice temperature, if the lattice temperature is very low, it probably doesn't get all the way there. If the lattice temperature is 100 Kelvin, I think the electron energy relaxation to 100 Kelvin is pretty good. But then I think the spin relaxation is much longer.
So there was this picture of the flying rate, and that assumes, and you were saying some words about ballistic current rate, so the picture that at least I had was that you generate those currents, you apply these to each other, you relax each other, but that sort of implies some equilibrium momentum distribution. So that sort of goes against what you're saying now.
I don't think if you work out the details, it goes against what I'm saying, but I'd kind of like to get to the second part of the talk, if that's okay. But yeah, so okay, I don't think that the when I say ballistic, the assumption there, all I mean is that the scattering length is longer than the distance between the peaks. Now there are two. Okay, so the assumption there is that the electrons relax rapidly through some rapid process to a quasi-thermal distribution with the initial spin density. So that happens before they're even really moving around. Then I think the motion from there, even if that initial distribution is in local thermal equilibrium, I think that the fact that the scattering time is longer than the period of the grating means that you don't see simple diffusion. So that's saying that there's a quick energy relaxation time to get down to low enough energy that they can't simply give up energy that way, then the electron impurity scattering times kick in, and those are much longer.
So at least generally the regime you're in there is need to be half larger than the micron?
At low enough temperature, yes. So the caveats that you're thinking is there. At low enough temperature, once the electrons have initially relaxed to some quasi Fermi distribution at fairly low temperature, the mean free path is pretty long. At least it seems experimentally to be. Okay, so a little puzzle for what happens at low density is the argument that in a metal, spin diffusion constant, we just said, is in general less than the charge diffusion constant. That ordering flips around if you start to look at magnets that are insulating, say. So a simple example would be if I look at the Hubbard model at half filling at large enough U where it's an insulator, then there's no charge diffusion. Transport is by hopping or some other mechanism. But spin diffusion can still exist. If I just imagine mapping the Hubbard model to some kind of Heisenberg model, spin can propagate through magnons without ever having to move charges around. So you expect that as you move toward an insulator, this is kind of a heuristic argument, but as you move toward an insulator of charge, you don't necessarily move toward a perfect insulator of spin, so there should be some point in that path of going to an insulator where spin and charge diffusion constants flip. The problem, which is a little bit difficult, is that if you start to look at these semiconductors at lower densities, for example, if you've got anywhere near the transition to a Wigner crystal, that's very sensitive to disorder. And to do a calculation that involves electron interactions in a semiconductor at low density of spin transport, at this point, I don't think has really been done. So I think that would be a nice thing to have. And then I was going to mention, there's, if you ask, well, is this drag good for anything, or is it just a drag? There's a result today on the archive that I thought was pretty neat about how do you actually use these kind of drag effects. It's a different drag effect, but is there, aside from just having a low spin diffusion constant, is there an actual positive use for this kind of drag effect? There's an argument that you can create an efficient spin current generator from charge currents by using the properties of Coulomb drag between wires in a magnetic field. So this just appeared by Postolnik, Mashenko, and Starek on the archive today. Yes, these are two one-dimensional wires, and I don't think the effect would be nearly as strong with bilayers.
I think Starek will be here this afternoon and tomorrow. I'm talking about this tomorrow morning.
Okay, so it's an advertisement for Oleg's talk. All right, so now that I've used up most of my time, let me talk a little bit about the spin Hall effect to prove that I am actually a theorist. So the ordinary Hall effect of electrons in a metal, if I look at it from a symmetry point of view, then it's simply some current that flows along E cross B, whether I'm talking about spin currents or charge currents. And in particular, if I'm going to talk about dissipationless currents, then everything should be consistent with symmetry. The reason why this equation is consistent with symmetry is just that, and this argument is old hat, so I'll go through it quickly. Magnetic field changes sign under time reversal. Ordinary currents change sign under time reversal. Electric fields do not, so both sides are properly odd under time reversal. Now let's go and look at the spin Hall current. Well, quick argument for why spin Hall effect is allowed that you've probably heard before in this workshop is I can have a dissipationless current. I only need one field on the right because now I've got two indices on the left. I do need to break inversion symmetry. And here, dissipationless current, both sides are even under time reversal. The quick reason why spin currents are even under time reversal, there's one power of inverse time because every current involves a velocity. And there's another power of inverse time because it's a current of angular momentum. So there are a couple of different proposals. One, of course, the older one would be extrinsic, having to do with impurity scattering from Dyakonov and Perel. Of course, recent interest is on more intrinsic and significantly larger spin Hall effects generated, for example, by Rochebe coupling. What I'm going to talk about is something that may be quite hard to realize experimentally, honestly, but at least theoretically is pretty appealing, especially for people who used to work on the quantum Hall effect. If you go look at the idea of when could you have a robust spin Hall effect that in the bulk is protected by a gap, very much like the ordinary integer quantum Hall effect, then you're led to a class of band structures like graphene, and I'll explain why some materials are good for this kind of spin Hall effect. Obviously, one nice motivation for a spin Hall effect is that it'd be a nice mechanism to generate spin currents. And of course, this is very close to what Donna Sheng was talking about. So just a quick reminder, why is the ordinary charge quantum Hall effect so robust? Well, I'm going to talk mostly about edges. So here's a picture for the ordinary quantum Hall effect simply based on edge physics. If I look in the bulk, well, here it's actually drawn with the Fermi level at the bottom of a band, but if I had the Fermi level in between two Landau levels, then the only gapless excitations are at the edge of the system. And in fact, I can count the number of edge excitations, sorry, the number of edge modes by counting the number of Landau levels that are crossed somewhere by the Fermi level. And what's special about these edges, they're actually chiral, at least for the integer quantum Hall effect. Each edge has a specific direction of propagation, and there are no propagating modes in the opposite direction. So it's kind of like a one-way street. And that, the reason why that makes the edge especially stable is that there's nothing to backscatter into at low energy. Where's experimental pictures? Okay, so what I'm going to talk about now, I think goes back to an old idea of Haldane, which is that even though you do need to have broken time reversal just on symmetry grounds to have a quantum Hall effect, you don't actually need to have a net magnetic flux. An example of a system that breaks time reversal without a net magnetic flux is an antiferromagnet. So if you want an example of this, suppose that you could create a system where spin-up electrons would feel something like a magnetic field pointing along Z, spin-down electrons would feel something like a magnetic field pointing along minus Z. So if you play around, you'll notice that this does conserve time reversal. Obviously, it breaks SU2. And if you ask, well, if I could really do this, and if up electrons were totally independent of down electrons, then in the simplest case, you might have, say, a clockwise moving spin-up mode of electrons and a counterclockwise moving spin-down mode of electrons. Now, that sounds a little fine-tuned. So most of what I talk about is going to be trying to show that that situation is actually stable.
The reason why I
say it's fine-tuned is that once we've broken SU2, if I didn't have some additional conserved quantity like SZ, so keeping SZ as a conserved quantity would be very fine-tuned. We'd expect that in the presence of disorder, once SU2 is broken, there should be some scattering between spin-up to spin-down. It turns out that that's only present for some band structures, and there are certain band structures where there's effectively a selection rule that forbids localization, at least localization by single particle scattering. So the punchline is going to be, even though you now have a one-dimensional conductor with excitations going in both directions, which experience teaches us should be pretty unstable, there's a special stability of that system when there's a single pair of time-reversed edge modes. It's related to the sort of lore that you can't scatter within a time-reversed pair of excitations, a Cramer's pair, if the overall Hamiltonian is T-invariant. So we worked on this, and then independently and at exactly the same time, Kongjun Wu and Andre Bernovig, both of whom are here, also worked, and there's some of the same cases that we studied. So the simplest band structure that gives rise to a single pair of time-reversed edge modes was introduced by Kane and Millay. It's single layer of graphene with a certain kind of spin orbit coupling that I'll talk about in a second. The real motivation maybe for studying the edge here, since there's a bulk in the gap, you expect that there's a gap in the bulk will be very robust to any sort of weak perturbation. So we only need to look at the edge. The edge, a nice thing about one-dimensional systems is that we have non-perturbative methods for both disorder and interaction strength that we don't typically have in higher dimensions. So I think aside from the spin Hall effect, which we're all certainly interested in, maybe one motivation for why you should go and read the various papers by Kane and Millay is that it makes a very deep proposal that there are really two kinds of insulators. We always thought that insulators, at least in the absence of T breaking, were pretty boring. Maybe if you broke T, you could have something like a quantum Hall insulator, something like that. But the point of the Kane and Millay paper is that there are really two different kinds of insulator. There's the ordinary insulator, which would have an even number of Cramer's pairs of edge modes, even number of time-reversed pairs, which might just be zero, or it might be that I've got spin-up and spin-down left movers, spin-up and spin-down right movers. But then there's a special kind of insulator, sometimes called the topological insulator, which has an odd number of Cramer's pairs. And that the difference between this and this is very robust, and whether there's a simple distinction in the bulk without counting the number of edge modes, at the moment most of the distinctions in the bulk seem pretty complicated. And there may be some room to clear that up. So I'll just say a tiny bit about the bulk and how, to what extent it's analogous and to what extent it isn't to the ordinary quantum Hall effect. So in the ordinary quantum Hall effect, a very important part of understanding the integer quantum Hall effect in kind of a universal way was a series of papers in the 1980s about why is the conductance quantized, and in general, given a band structure, or even not given a band structure, but given some many-body quantum state, how can you tell what its integer Hall quantum will be, assuming a gap, etc. So the original expression was, well, for each band, I can define a so-called TKNN integer, Thouless, Komodo, Nightingale, Den Nice, I suppose. Then this integer is just a property of the block wave functions. This is a certain integral over the Brillouin zone that will always give you an integer. And there's such an integer defined for each band. Now, if you want to talk about many-body stability of the integer quantum Hall effect, then you shouldn't really have access to the block wave functions. You should only have the total ground state of the system. And I won't go into this since Donna talked about it. If you define some twist angles at the boundary of the system and look at the response of these wave functions to those twist angles, then you can again define something that turns out to be an integer and turns out to give you sigma xy. So what about the spin quantum Hall effect? And this is partly motivated by trying to answer some questions that came up in Donna's talk. Well, one case is easy. If we have a quantum number like SZ in a T-invariant system that lets us break up bands into, say, spin-up bands and spin-down bands, or even if it's not spin, if there's any quantum number that lets me classify all my bands into two kinds, then I can define a churn number for each of those bands. And even if the total churn number is fixed to be zero by t invariance, the difference between churn numbers will give me something like a number of Cramer's pairs of edge modes. And this is very specific to the case where I can define a quantum number that lets me classify bands. In this special case where there's an extra quantum number, then I don't need a Z2 classification. I actually have a full classification in terms of two integers. However, once SU2 is broken, we don't expect this to happen in general. So the claim is that, let me make one little caveat, which is even if you do have a quantum number that's not exactly SZ, you wouldn't expect a robustly quantized spin Hall effect. But the worst situation of all is when you don't even have any such quantum number to classify bands. And then there's kind of a complicated argument in the bulk that even without that conserved number, there's a Z2 conservation law, which is, again, the number of Cramer's pairs of edge modes. And what I want to talk about is what are the physical consequences of that looking at the edge.
And then come back and try and get
to the bulk later. So here's the quick argument for why edge is stable to single particle scattering by time reversal symmetric perturbations. So I'll come back in a second to why graphene is special. Let me just focus on, suppose that psi and phi are two edge excitations that are time reversal conjugates of each other, and that H is a time reversal symmetric Hamiltonian. Well, using the fact, I guess I won't go through this in the interest of time, time reversal is not a unitary operator, it's actually an anti-unitary operator. But combining what you know about anti-unitarity and the T invariance of the Hamiltonian, you can show that this is equal to the same thing with the minus sign, which just says that there's no mixing between the left mover and the right mover if they're T conjugates of each other. So for example, if I had spin up moving left and spin up moving right, those two are not T conjugates of each other. They can localize perfectly well. So if I didn't have to worry about spin because all the particles have the same spin, I would get localization. If I didn't have fermions, I would also get localization. So the key property in this argument, the one thing that's a bit non-trivial, is that fermions are different from bosons in that T squared is minus 1 instead of 1 for fermions. But from that, it's not too hard. So the overview of what we can say about spin excitations is that, first of all, as I said, there's a Z2 index that I'll try to give a bit of intuition for when I talk about graphene in a second. But if I'm in the topological insulator, then the edge is very stable, because if I've got a single pair of edge modes, then at least elastic scattering is never going to let me scatter from left mover to right mover, which means there won't be any localization. Even if you have an even number of pairs, it turns out that it is possible for either attractive or repulsive interactions to stabilize the edge, but to do it with repulsive interactions requires a bit of fine-tuning, so it's probably pretty difficult experimentally. So without going through the details, I did kind of want to give people a feel for how you approach this sort of edge state problem if you haven't worked much on the quantum Hall effect. The standard picture of edge states, the quantum Hall effect, goes back to Wien. The idea is that one has a one-dimensional Fermi system with interactions, which one can convert to a free boson system. Typically, there's one chiral boson for each propagating mode. This is the chiral boson action. And then the way that we represent the effect of disorder, we'd like to understand whether localization happens. And the picture of disorder is just as some spatially random process that, if you are familiar with bosonization, these exponentials have the effect of converting, say, a left mover to a right mover or vice versa. So the key physics of spin Hall edges is that if I have a single pair, Cramer's pair of left mover and right mover, then the leading operator that would normally give rise to localization is forbidden by the symmetry principle I just told you about. I could still hop two left movers to two right movers in the presence of interactions. So it is eventually possible to localize, but it takes quite a strong interaction strength. And then, as I said, even in the two-edge case, you can make it stable, but the point of studying the edge, I guess, is that you can show microscopically why the topological insulator is much more stable than the ordinary insulator. And it, from the point of view of one-dimensional physics, it's just a little bit interesting because of the selection rule, which changes a lot of the conventional wisdom about 1D systems. So the last thing I want to say on this topic is just a little bit about why graphene should be a topological insulator. or what particular kind of spin orbit coupling is in there. Okay, so here's a microscopic model for graphene. This is a tight binding term on the honeycomb lattice. This is a staggered sublattice potential if you were dealing with boron nitride or some other material where the atoms weren't identical. The two terms to focus on, maybe, this is a particular kind of spin orbit coupling. I don't know if it has a name, and I don't know if it's been that much discussed in the past. It involves second neighbor hopping and a coupling to SZ. It's different from the conventional Rochba spin orbit coupling in that Rochba results when you break the mirror symmetry in the Z direction. This doesn't depend on breaking mirror symmetry in the Z direction. And this is nice in that it conserves SZ. So if you forget about Rochba, then we're in the easy case where SZ is conserved and the problem decomposes into a spin-up quantum Hall effect and a spin-down quantum Hall effect. Adding in Rochba is when you really get into the challenging situation because now SZ is not conserved. And one should say that the effect of Rochba here is opposite the effect of Rochba in other versions of the spin Hall effect. We want Rochba to be small. Rochba actually is destructive of the spin Hall effect when you're talking about this kind of spin Hall effect.
Where do you get this at all, this Rochba term, from in graphene?
Typically, graphene will be deposited as a layer on something. So it would be, I'm assuming that Rochba is generated by some breaking of mirror symmetry in the Z direction. If there's no breaking of the Z direction, then this term will disappear.
I'm not sure whether this gives you a significant effect, but anyway.
You can estimate the size of the Rochba effect by the electric field in the Z direction that results from whatever confining. Yeah, I don't know that Rochba is effectively strong.
You do not have spin orbit coupling significantly in graphene.
Yeah.
So that's the basic point.
I think there is a big debate at the moment about even how large is this coupling. So the original paper estimated 5 Kelvin. And then a later paper came out saying that that estimate was about 100 times too optimistic. So at the moment,
it's only about 1,000.
1,000 times too optimistic. Okay. So
the
yes.
Second term would be even weaker because the generator needs to couple to other orbitals. So the structure of the field can be comparable.
The second term is non-universal in that it's dependent upon the strength of the Z breaking by whatever you put the graphene on, right? I mean, like the first is intrinsic.
Also, it is very strongly surprised by the large gap between
the orbital. And this you think is about 1,000 times smaller than 15 Kelvin is the order of magnitude. Yeah, I think from an experimental point of view, graphene is probably not the ideal material. The basic reason why it's a problem, as you all know, spin orbit coupling depends very much on atomic number. There are other semi-metals. I mean, bismuth is a semi-metal. I don't know if it has the right band structure. I don't think it does, actually. But graphene at the moment, I think, is attractively simple. But because the element carbon is too light, the spin orbit coupling is too weak for this to be really plausible. At least above 50 millikelvin or so. But remember that people in the quantum Hall effect, at least in the fractional quantum Hall effect, routinely work at below 50 millikelvin. So even if it's 100 times smaller than 15 Kelvin, I think that would probably rule it out for practical applications,
but not
necessarily for experimental observation. 1,000 times smaller, that would be a real problem. The last thing I wanted to say was I think that there are some nice efforts, and certainly the early papers of Kane and Melle are very important, but the understanding of the Z2 classification, if you want to put it in mathematical terms, there's really a dramatic difference between the ordinary Chern number case and this Z2 topological insulator. And that's, when I talk about the Chern number case, there's actually one integer for each band. If I don't worry about many body physics, if I just look at band structures, it's really Z infinity rather than just Z. Here, in this topological insulator, there are only two numbers. If now I look at a multiple band structure, instead of having z to the infinite power, you've got one integer that counts the number of bands and one z2 element that tells you whether you have an even or odd number of edge pairs. But how exactly you go from this Chern picture to this new picture when you turn on a term like the Rochba coupling, I don't think it's completely understood.
This is definitely bulk Hamiltonian. So how do you do that?
You put a potential on the spatial edge of the system.
How do you choose direction of that?
You mean what determines Whether
the change is not,
it's because
like the long one of the crystallographic direction, but it will differ between Belleg's and this will definitely change the edge state.
I think that if there is a propagating edge state, I mean, you can't scatter between the left mover and the right mover. I mean, if the edges are far enough apart, the bulk is gapped, so it can't really go anywhere in the bulk, right? There's a gap in the bulk of order lambda SO. Like, that is, it's gapless without these terms. But then adding this, what was that? Yeah, that's right. It may be a small gap, but there is a, I mean, even though graphene, yeah, I should have said this more clearly, even though graphene is ordinarily a semi-metal.
You also assume that it is perfectly pure inside the system.
I assume that there's a gap in the bulk. I mean, if it's impure, then the impurity is not so strong that it spoils the gap. That's what I assume.
And you assume that the lanes determined by the gap according to something.
Yeah, that's right. So the ordinary, yeah, that's right. The typical assumption in the quantum Hall effect is that not only is there a gap in the bulk, but the gap is large enough and the edges are far apart enough that there's no significant tunneling from one edge to the other. Well, okay. As far as whether this is just a theoretical proposal or not, I think finding any example of this spin, of this topological insulator, you know, whether or not it has a measurable spin Hall effect, is to show that this exists as a state of matter, I at least would find pretty interesting. I think it's worth looking for. So then the last thing I quickly want to say in 5 minutes, I promise, is a little bit about something else we work on that I would like other people to get interested in. Let me say a tiny bit about quantum entanglement of many spin systems, because we're sort of looking problems to attack with this. So very briefly, what entanglement means is the following nice property of quantum mechanics. There are some states of bipartite systems, and for simplicity, let me take a system that just consists of two spins, where not only do I have a pure state of the whole system, but if you come along and ask me what is the wave function of spin A, I can give you a perfectly good answer. I can say that the wave function of spin A is up, and we call this a product state. There are other cases where, for example, if I look at a spin singlet, if you want to torture an undergrad in your quantum mechanics class, you can write down this wave function and ask them, well, what is the wave function of spin A? So they'll probably try to write something like up minus down or up plus down, but there's actually no pure state that describes
spin A
in a singlet. In fact, the correct description is as a density matrix. And in particular, it's the density matrix of a mixed state, which means that it has an entropy. So entanglement is just the idea, or at least the definition of entanglement that I think is most useful for condensed matter, is that when you look at a subsystem, there's an entropy created. So why should you care? This is the formal definition. Let me explain why I think this might actually have a bit of impact. There's a relationship between the entanglement of a quantum state, or so-called the quantum information in the state, and how much difficulty is required, or how much difficulty there is in using a classical computer to understand that state. And the reason is that product states require very little information to describe. Entangled states require a lot. So an example would be, let me just ask, how much room in my computer does it take to store a product state of n spins? So product state means well-defined wave function for spin 1, well-defined wave function for spin 2, dot, dot, dot. Well, as you all know, for a general quantum state that's not a product state, it requires exponentially much information in the system size. So linear versus exponential is certainly a big difference. But we know that if we only had product states, life would be a lot less interesting. We wouldn't have magnetism. We wouldn't have very many correlated electron phenomena. So the thing that I wanted to advertise quickly is that there's been a fair amount of work in the last few years on understanding how much entanglement is there in ground states of the kind of local Hamiltonians that we care about in condensed matter physics, whether it's spin Hamiltonians or the Hubbard model or whatever. And the moral of the story is that there's always more entanglement than in simple product states, but there's much less entanglement than in a general state. So the kind of Hamiltonians we care about generate a sort of moderate amount of entanglement entropy. To be precise, the largest amount of entanglement is at a quantum critical point. At a quantum critical point, let me look at a quantum critical point in one dimension, and let me look at the entanglement of a connected set of n spins with all the others. So my subsystem A is a set of n spins in a row. Subsystem B is everything else. Even at criticality, when that's as large as it can be, it grows logarithmically in n rather than linearly in n. So this is saying that, effectively, even the most entangled ground states of local Hamiltonians are not all that entangled. And if you're curious, there's actually a universal coefficient in front of the logarithm that's related to the central charge of the CFT that describes the critical point in 1D. So the reason why I say there's some progress, well, first of all, in 1D at quantum critical points, there's a universal logarithm related to the central charge if the critical point is conformally invariant. You also get a universal logarithm that is a logarithm with a universal coefficient in 1D, even if you don't have conformal invariance, for example, even for random quantum critical spin chains. So that means that entanglement entropy is the right way to measure critical entropy at quantum critical points. Then there are some results on free fermions in higher dimensions and on some somewhat exotic points in higher dimensions. But the real reason why I think this is valuable is not being able to do some cute analytic calculations. It's that we now have a pretty good argument that the reason why density matrix renormalization group is such a great way to do quantum many-body physics in one dimension, its success is associated with this property of ground states not having that much entanglement. So the hope that many people, and certainly we're interested in doing it, but the progress to this point has been made mostly by these five and some other people as well, is that you can use these ideas about entanglement entropy to make new algorithms for higher dimensional correlated systems. So first of all, there should be more experiments to probe many-body entanglement because you sort of need that for quantum computing. But the thing I want to stress to this audience is that if you have hard but important problems of interacting spins in 2D, those are exactly the kind of problems that are needed in order to drive the development of new algorithms. So if you have a problem, say, that has a sign problem or is otherwise not really simulable by a current approach, then contact us or one of this group of people, and then we'll have a way to check, because I think the open question at this point is whether these new algorithms in higher dimensions are really any better than what we know how to do. And the only way to sort that out is to actually have some important problems that are worth studying and see if what's new is actually better than what's old. So that's it. Thank you. We had a couple questions during the talk.